Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers, and welcome to the Slacker Podcast. This is a much subdued introduction because I don't want to be as loud as I normally am because I couldn't sleep and I'm up at 6 in the morning and I'm recording this. So, and I'm in a cabin at the back of my house and I kind of get the vibe that my neighbors can hear every single thing that I do. So I'm not going to start shouting at the top of my lungs just yet. Let's let them ease into the day. Give them a false sense of security. Then start shouting. Then ruin their day. See, I think that's definitely the more devious plan of it. You're very welcome to the Slacker Podcast. This is absolutely brand new and fresh to you. It is a podcast based around music. All of the guests that we have on, of course, are musicians, artists, or some way connected to it. And we bring them on and we play some of their earliest demos, some demos from current projects, and we talk about their career. And we try and ask the questions that normally aren't asked. And this week, of course, we'll get to it a little bit more in a minute, but we've got Matt Berninger from The National, who has brought a demo from his new project, which is Matt Berninger from The National, because he's going solo. But big love to everybody who is donating to the Patreon of the Slacker Podcast. We have been keeping this going weekly since March this year. There's about 60 odd episodes up there over the last couple of years since we've been doing this. And yeah, I'm just trying to give you guys as much content as possible. Up on the Patreon, we have the Slacker playlist that we have there. I do sort of sporadic Patreon only podcasts. Yeah, it's just like a little community that we've got going on there. So if you go to patreon.com/slackerpodcast, you can join the community, you can donate there and for very, very little and keep this podcast thing rolling and basically keep me getting new mics and stuff so everything sounds better. Okay, so this week it's Matt Berninger from The National, as I've just told you. He is a massively charming dude. He got one of the biggest reactions that I've ever got when I tweeted about him coming on the podcast. It seems to be the National fans that follow me are out and loud, and they want to hear themselves heard, which is great, and I'm excited for them to hear this today because I feel that they'll get as much out of this as I did, because he's just a very, very interesting guy to talk to about politics, about music, about pretty much everything, and he's funny as well, really, really funny. So here it is, the Slacker Podcast with Matt Berninger in 3, 2, gotta keep whispering, 1. It's to Slacker Podcast, and we have got Matt Berninger here for us. How you doing? Are you well? Are you good?
Yeah. Well, relatively, I would say.
I think relatively in 2020, relatively good in 2020. Any other year would be crushingly depressed, I think.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, in the face of all this, horror, I've been figuring out a way to sort of try to imagine the other side of it. And I think the other side of all this stuff, I think, will be a healthier place in some ways than where we were coming from.
Yeah, you know, I get that.
As long as we can get there, you know.
That's true. I've given up smoking. I suppose that's a good thing, right? Everybody knows
you. That's good. I picked it back up. Everybody's doing what they got to do, but I've been mostly just, you know, trying to stay busy and just try to chill and not get too sucked into all the doom and gloom, you know.
We've got a really wicked demo from you to start, called Love So Little. So I'm just gonna blast a little bit of it in now, okay?
Yeah.
So do you want me to have you heard this demo recently? What's your do you wanna hear it?
Yeah.
You do wanna hear it? Okay.
Well, I've heard it recently. I listened to it again, but yeah, it's almost 2 years old or something, this one and the demo for Distant Access were the first songs that I sent to Booker, actually, that were the originals. And this one he was really, really sort of obsessed with. I wrote this with Mike Brewer, who was in my first band, Nancy. It's just Mike sent me he sits on his couch or sits wherever and just sends me these little guitar ditties, you know, that are just anything and everything. And this one just right away had this vibe. And so this was something I had kind of sitting around for a while. I was singing all the backing vocals on the demo, but it's basically just me and Mike Brewer on guitar. So yeah, go ahead and play it. But it turned into a whole different thing. And Booker, this is one of the ones that Booker really fell in love with first.
Okay.
Thank you.
something. Get out of the tether when you're in it enough. I'm just getting caught in the middle of this so hard to be loved, so little lonely. Get out of the tether when you're in it enough. I'm just getting caught in the middle of this so hard to be loved. So
that was a demo of Matt Berninger's track "Love So Little." Obviously, it's different. All but the majority of demos are different to what ends up on the album. But sometimes the ones on the album, it's hard to recapture the instant vibe that you always get with a demo. Do you find that?
Yeah, and that can be a really dangerous thing to get to, you know. Demoitis is a real condition. It's a medical condition, and I always used to have it. And yeah, there is something that often is lost when you go into a studio, and so it's a fine line between being too obsessed with the lo-fi vibe of your demo and still capturing that sort of fresh, unpolished, unthought about, expression. And sometimes when you record it with all these people and all the best gear and everybody's in the studio, all the anxiety and too many opportunities to polish it to the point where it's maybe loses some of its rough humanity, you know. And so yeah, it's a very tricky balance, and I'm always thinking about that.
Where does that track sit in the sort of like the tracks that you have on this album in terms of like how important it is? Because like, was this the track that made you think going, you know, I'm going to do a solo album, or were you well into the mind frame of going, I'm going to do this anyway by that stage?
When I wrote this song, no, I had no intention of making a solo album. I've written a lot of songs with Mike Brewer, and we just have like bits and pieces of songs that we've been like, we should do something with these someday. And same goes with like almost everybody who's on this record. Walter Martin, I've done a lot of songs with him on his records, and he's sent me a lot of different things, and Hayden Desser. But so all these people are people that I've been kind of sharing little ideas with for a long time. And this one though, when I wrote it, it was just like one of those. But going back in kind of collecting, when I started working with Booker, collecting different half-baked ideas, that like maybe I should do some originals and see if he's interested in any of these. This one stood out. So I sent him two. I sent him this one and Distant Axis, because there was something about this song that I wanted to put out somewhere, and I didn't want to start another band or anything. But so I guess writing this song is so much of it was I just kind of wanted to write a sexy song, you know, this like sort of really there are these two characters and you're not sure like who's saying what to who, you know, and it's this sort of a dalliance, you know, there's a courtship, you know, kind of going on but you know, with people with a history, you know, or something like that. So I wanted to write one of these, like, you know,
you've written those sexy songs before. My friend, like, when I said I was doing this, my friend Emily said to me, she like the first thing that she said was like, thank him for writing "I'm the Man to Be." It's one of the sexiest songs of all time.
That's I think that's sexy in sort of a maybe Jim Carrey jackassy sort of sexy way. It's funny.
What, when Jim Carrey speaks out of his ass? Is like that sort of way are we talking?
Well, just sexy in the way, in the way Pet Detective sexy, I guess. I don't know.
What was the conference like when you were chatting to the rest of the guys in the band and you're like going, right, I'm going to do a solo album? Like, is there even a conversation, or is it like they pick up, like they Pitchfork or look at Pitchfork one day and they see that you're doing a solo album?
No,
how do you broach that?
No, a long, long time ago, I told all those guys that I was working on a record with Booker, you know, and then in the process of making the, you know, it started as a covers record, but in the process in the studio, and just more original sort of bubbled up and along the whole process. And so, you know, and Scott wrote one of those. And those guys knew everything about this project. For the whole time. And, you know, I sent everybody in the band the finished record like a long time ago, or like the rough mixes probably 6 months ago or something like that.
Yeah.
or something. So that was, it wasn't at all any kind of a secret. It evolving from a covers album into a solo album happened sort of towards the end, like more in the studio. And it's still sort of both, though. It's like the deluxe version has almost all the covers on there too. It's like a combination. The record proper, the 10 song record, I wanted it not to be too long, so I just put the originals together. And but it all still feels like a big combination of a covers album and a solo thing, you know.
I think you did the right thing by putting original songs on it, because if it hadn't have worked out, you would be in the pantheon of cover albums with a luminary such as Guns N' Roses' The Spaghetti Incident and Metallica's Garage Inc. At least now it keeps you out of that conversation.
Well, I mean, honestly, I that is a... I wanted it to be a short record. I like Stardust, which is like kind of a sonic model and a cosmic spiritual model for this record. Stardust by Willie Nelson is, I think, 10 songs. And, even now, I think it's this record is like longer than a lot of my favorite records, you know, Is This It, you know, by The Strokes is shorter than this record. I think their first two records are even shorter than this. I like short records.
Yeah, me too. I'm a big fan of them.
Play and repeat, you know. And so I wanted that. But then I had all these songs. So, yeah, the deluxe is a little bit of a maximalist package, and the regular record's more of a finely tuned sort of little record.
Yeah, I remember like when I first got into The Strokes, like when they first came out, I was 12 or something, and I had The Strokes and Hate to Say I Told You So by The Hives, and I used to listen to them at the same time, and both together were only 45 minutes. Like, it was less than an hour and you get two albums in, which I think's great and still thinks great to this day. But like I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about kind of like the music scenes that you were like into when you were growing up. Like what sort of like kid were you, like when you were growing up in Cincinnati, like what sort of like style of music did you have, like a sort of a tribe, or
how did well it I mean like in until my sister brought home U2 and the Smiths and Violent Femmes and that stuff, I was listening to Van Halen and I do remember, I mean, playing basketball with all my grade school friends and listening to just whatever was on, you know, WEBN or Q102 in Cincinnati, which are just, you know, kind of schlock rock, but it was, but I loved it, you know. I think it was The Queen Is Dead by the Smiths and that Violent Femmes, you know, their eponymous first record. Like when I heard those two records specifically, I remember like there is a whole other way to you know, there's literature in music, not just entertainment, right? And so that's where I started paying attention to songs and the writing, and those artists led me to everything else, you know, the Pixies and all everything, then eventually Leonard Cohen and Nick Cave and all that stuff,
which, yeah,
you know, became
and like
Tom Waits. Yeah,
I quite like it when you get into a group that like the Smiths are a great example, because they were their influences aesthetically and sonically on their sleeve. So like, you know, you will go, they will reference artists that they're into. You'll go back to glam rock, go back to the girl groups, like the doo-wop stuff. I've had Johnny Marr on the podcast, which I really enjoyed.
Nicest guy, one of the nicest guys I've ever met, yeah.
Very much so. And also somebody who can jump from band to band and still and manage to like chameleon his way into the and Modest Mouse and the Cribs.
That's when we met him. Yeah, we opened for Modest Mouse and then, you know, an REM at the same time. And yeah, I mean, just being on tour with Johnny Marr was just so cool, you know.
Yeah, he still looks younger than I do, and I'm like in my like early 30s, and it's really annoying.
He would get out of the bus and jog every morning, you know, and he had his jogging shorts on. I'm like, there goes Johnny Marr, just, you know, running in his and his like silky jogging shorts. It was just like, that, how did that happen to my life?
He's packing plectrums. As much as I adored having Johnny Marr on the podcast, I think that's as much as I would be scared to have Morrissey on the podcast, because he kind of feels like he's like growing into the sort of Batman quote. What is it like, you know, you live long enough to be the hero that you end up the villain. I'm paraphrasing, like, but you know what I mean. Like, like Morrissey is just one of those people now that you're like, it makes it very hard for me to enjoy the Smiths music still.
I have gone through that struggle because yeah, and Morrissey's writing for me was very much a beacon of sort of like light at the end of the tunnel in terms of like how a person can have, you know, the courage to express their complicated self in such fun and incredibly entertaining and brave ways. And so, yeah, it is difficult to square the writing of a person with such empathy and such sort of joy or something, you know, mixed with torture and self-loathing. But and then, yeah, what he says now is depressing, because it feels like he's turned off some sort of, or some sort of empathy capability is gone away or something. And yeah, and some of the things he says now I feel like kind of the opposite messages that I took from his writing, you know, when he was a younger man. And yeah, that's hard to square.
It is,
I still love, I can listen to The Queen Is Dead and The Smiths and just find that I can still find that empathy and that kindness and that bravery when I listen to that stuff. Yeah.
Does it make you how does it sit with you, really, knowing that feeling that you get from putting that album on, other people get from putting your music on? Because like, I've noticed about like National fans is like, and your fans is like, they're feverish, they're hardcore, like they it's not just like going, oh, I really like, it's like I love, like they speak loud and proud. So so your music makes a lot of other people feel that strength that you talked about. The Queen Is Dead,
I mean, that's like the highest, that's like what you really hope, and that's yeah. But I mean it's not like everything I put out there I feel was as good as it could have been, or you know, would have done it the same way, but I can't really put a song out unless it's, for me, it's really doing something for me, genuinely and emotionally. And it's like, it's unpacking something that I needed to unpack for real. That wasn't necessarily easy to unpack, sort of. Some of them are just fun songs, but cathartic songs, but so the songs have to do that for me. And so that's the only way I can trust that maybe it's going to work for someone else, right? So just having faith in your own emotional reaction to what you're doing is really the only measurement, I think, that makes any sense for an artist when they're doing art. Because if you're trying to, and so I guess that I'm happy that it seems like people connect to it that way, the same way I connect to it, you know, and makes me assume that like Nick Cave and Nina Simone are actually really, really genuinely connecting to everything they're writing. And it wasn't a product that they were packaging, you know, as a follow-up to this product or that product. It was just art, just truth. And, you know, mixed with craft, but for me, it's kind of like, I just, if it moves me, just the chances are it'll move someone else. And like, that's, I've been lucky to remind myself of that a lot. And because it is, you work on a song and sometimes you're like, oh, we should turn it into this other thing that might be bigger or better. But then you're making craft instead of art, or you're making product there. And that's it's really easy to lose people when they can hear that, when they can hear that you're not being genuine, you're just trying to,
press
some buttons.
Yeah, you know, I mean, fans will be able to sniff that out in a second. Like if they ever think that like somebody they like is dancing for coins, like they will absolutely let them know at any given point.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Well, I remember like when I played in my band and something bad would happen, so like somebody, it would be like, say like the guitarist in our band got dumped or something, it would be like, we'll get a really good EP out of this. And you always hear this, like when something bad happens in an artist's life, oh, you'll get a great piece of music out of this. And I never really like questioned that until quite recently, where I was thinking, that's kind of a really bleak way of looking at art, that you have to go through pain to be able to create. Like I feel like that's not really a modern way of thinking.
I mean, that is a cliche, and that is like, and so, but the idea of pain is just being alive is just, you know, and is painful on a daily basis, is emotionally something. I don't know any, I've never met anybody who doesn't have a genuine healthy amount of pain in their life. Some people have much more. Some people have had much. I've been very, very blessed and very lucky that I've had amazing parents. I have amazing friends. I've been very lucky in all that. But still trying to figure out how to be a decent person and a happy person is a struggle for everyone, you know. And then some, mm-hmm. you know, and then people with actually, you know, genuine depression, those are motivating things, and that's what artists do. They take they create something out of the stuff that's impossible sort of to write down and describe with words. Well, I mean, some can, novelists, they do it, but you have to make art sometimes that is a bit abstract in order to communicate the abstract emotional thing you're feeling, which is often these like, why do I feel this, all this pain? And there's no reason I should. And so you can't just write that in an email to the world. You have to make something that embodies that actual blurry thing and embrace it and make something of it, make something beautiful out of it. And then you move on, you feel better. You know, it's physiological. I think artists kind of physically have to make something out of this, out of whatever, or else they get depressed, you know? And yeah. I found that with me, if I'm not making some kind of art, I get really depressed because that's really, I guess, the only place where I can get all that really blurry, ugly stuff out in a sort of presentable, non-humiliating way, yet it's still often really humiliating.
Yeah. If you've put out as many records as you have, like there's the likelihood that you have put out something that you may cringe at looking back on is fine. But I am interested in how you were talking about creativity, because as a music fan, I when I connect with something, I normally find myself between the words. Like if you wrote the words down on a piece of paper, or like I find myself somewhere in between, swimming around this double helix of like both like emotion and craft, as you say, and it's an interesting mix and something we could talk about forever and never understand, really.
I can tell a record is, you know, you listen to records and sometimes it takes a minute or two to connect or to find, you know, it's like meeting a person sometimes. Every record, even from the artists you may love, every one of their new records sometimes takes a minute to sort of settle into what's happening here. And but when I find myself, when I'm listening to a record, starting to listen to it again, and I find myself stopping and like, wait, what was that? And like going back 10, 15, 30 seconds, or, you know, scrolling back. And then I find myself, wait, I got to listen to that one more time. And then suddenly you can't get past song track or track three, you know, or song three or whatever. And then that's when, you know, this is when they keep impact, when it keeps revealing itself to you. And you keep discovering every time you listen to the song, you're like, wait, that's when you know there's more going on in between the lines. It's sparking your head. You want to try to connect the dots. It's that's when an artist engages, when they get you to go stop and like, what was that again?
Is there a song that comes to mind, like when you had that feeling? Because like, I know personally, when I listen to other radio stations and stuff, I'm screaming at the radio most of the time because they've done something I like or don't like. Mm-hmm. like what was the last song that you remember like stopping, or what a powerful
the
moment
last song I remember, the last song I remember like stopping,
or just like a powerful powerful moment that you were just like, I can't get past this bit of the song, I need to go back. Why do you know?
Well, there's been so many. There's like, I actually really think that so many artists right now are making just these incredible incredible works, and like Fiona Apple's record is just nuts, and you know, it's just in terms like beautifully just brave. And Punisher by Phoebe Bridgers is one that you just keep, like every single song is like you like, oh, there's so much more going on in this one. And yeah, even like the new Run the Jewels album, I'm really crazy about. I really love the new Future Islands album. It's sort of a mellower but real cosmic thing, and there's so many little bits and pieces, and so there's so many artists right now that I think are doing this really brave writing. You know, I think we're in a really good, really healthy place. Artists are doing a lot of amazing stuff, not just like but novelists and these incredible books and paintings are coming out now. And yeah, I mean, I think SNL in some of the late night shows are funnier than they've been and decades, you know, are starting to be here and there. And so this is and this kind of time is where, and it's not just been since pandemic, it's like, you know, 4 years of
Trump, yeah,
psycho, you know, leading our country, and we chose him, you know, like a criminal buffoon. Yeah, so artists have been digging pretty deep now for a few years, and it's really, I think we're having a real renaissance in art, you know, and in darken, like an enlightenment in art, and then an endarkenment in our geopolitical world. But that's kind of how it goes. Artists react first, I think, or react most directly first.
I like 100% agree, because like obviously your version of Trump is our version of Brexit, and we've got like the Diet Coke version. Yeah, we've got the Diet Coke version in Boris. But yeah, you're right. Like, I'm not necessarily, you don't necessarily see the fruits of the labor, of the turmoil that's happening in society, and until a couple of years down the road. And I think we're at that juncture now where there is a lot of great stuff, powerful stuff coming out. But it does make me think, it's like, would I give up that much good art and still have some decent art for an easier life, for a better president, for a better scenario in the UK?
Yeah. Well, you know what also is really interesting though? I mean, I'm not going to answer your question. I always do this, but I do think what I see and I'm really encouraged by is that artists and engagement in all these things and like a real embracing of the issues and not necessarily politics and issues in their art, but like getting out there and saying what they think about what's happening. And I think that's important. And artists for a long time, there was avoided that because, you know why? Because I think they watched too many Dylan documentaries where that was his thing. He just wouldn't be put in a corner, you know? And yeah, when you watch, you know, that all that stuff, the 60s and civil rights through the prism of just Dylan's coolness, you kind of like, it becomes this artist, and you know, always in your sometimes the industry in your career is telling you don't do this, play it safe. You know, you're an artist, it's not about politics. And I've if an artist isn't writing about all this stuff, I don't know what they're writing about, you know. And so Nina Simone would say that too. And so I think the more of the Nina Simone philosophy of no, say it all, get out there, stand by what you believe, stand up and say the things that no one else is going to say. That's your job as an artist. Now, you know, I know people don't like to be used as like a political tool, and the national sort of has been, you know, but we've embraced that and done our best to sort of navigate that weird territory. But artists that aren't writing about all this stuff, I think are just, it's like avoiding writing about love. You know, how do you avoid writing about all this stuff? You don't have to talk, it doesn't have to be like a political platform, but you have to at least, I don't know, you just have to be engaged in your world, and or else you're writing about, you know, something else. You're just making candy or something.
Well, I mean, what is your like sort of reaction to what's happening now? Because obviously you would have been with the band, and there's strength in numbers, and you know, you can talk about this with all the rest of the guys, and like I'm sure you have people around you can talk to about it as well. But as a united front, you supported Barack. As a united front, you know, you would have had music out in 2016.
I think it's a united front. That's a really bad. But that's the same thing with our name. We had the National had many shows boycotted throughout Europe because the idea that it's, you know, that we were some sort of nationalist thing. But anyway, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, sorry. Yeah, it was a bit of a mistake.
The National has very much, you know, been happy to
be involved your colors
and Obama's campaign and everything that we've done, and it, both individually, we're all individually really involved. We're all, and collectively, the National has found it. We don't feel like it's our responsibility, but we like to do it. So that'll never change, I don't think.
Because, like, well, the way I see it, like, from this side, because, like, you know, U.S. politics is world politics, really, at the end of the day. And, it, like, you know, when something happens in the U.S., it's news in the smallest of stations in Ireland. It's news in the U.K. I'm not hearing as much about this current election that's coming up at the start of November. I'm hearing, like, very, very little. I see the odd video here and there of, like, Trump having COVID and Sleepy Joe and a couple of bits and pieces like this, but it's by nowhere near as, like, pronounced. And I don't know whether that's a pandemic thing, but, like, what's it like with you? Does it feel as feverish as 16
felt? Oh, it feels 10 times more feverish. Than
really?
It
okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a grim reality that you know, hopefully in a few weeks we'll be on the other side of it and have survived it. But the grim reality is the democracy and American democracy is really, really genuinely, I think, at risk here. Ferris knows. and he's like, yep. No, because Trump is insane, and I do believe that the sycophants and the opportunists around him are not to be trusted at all. Everything we thought, you know, like no one thought Trump would ever even come close to winning, and then he did. And yes, with the help of the Russians, but with the help of a shitload of Americans too. And now what's happened over the course of his 4 years, the terror and what he's conjured up, the fear and anger and hate and white supremacy and racism and sexism, and he's conjured it, and he's turned up the heat on it. And now the idea that he might not even acknowledge the outcome of this election is terrifying. Yeah, it's genuinely terrifying. So not to freak you out, but yeah, Americans and it's a dark, we're looking over the edge right now for sure.
Wow, like I mean that's the best way I've heard it put. And it's got such a knock-on effect for the rest of the world, because if the rest of the world sees that they can have a leader like Donald Trump that stands for such things,
already, I mean, the damage he's done. I think we can't bring back the people that have the kids at the borders who've died, and the people who've died of COVID in this country and everywhere, and the total lack of any kind of sense of leadership from the United States in this administration is humiliating and devastating to most Americans too, and it's disgusting, so we'll never recover from some of that. But I do have an optimism that the curtain is being pulled back on all these, this deep, deep chronic American lies and false ideas of where, you know, of progress when we're, you know, our healthcare system, the racism, the sexism is just, you know, is right under the surface, and we have to fix that shit. And I do believe that now people, at least the generation younger than I am, most people are just won't tolerate it. The planet, what we're doing to the planet and everything. So regardless of what happens in the next few weeks, I do think that there's a new America blooming underneath this chaos and this devastation and destruction on top of it, which is doing genuine harm, irreparable harm. But I do believe that there's a new, younger America about to bloom, and hopefully it'll start soon.
I think that's just the scariest thing for me, not being in America, but the scariest thing, just like looking in, and it happens here as well, is just that there's a divide for the first time. Like people tend to now prescribe to one or the other, and that's scary, because like I never remembered it to be like that at any point in history. And I come from Northern Ireland, which was Catholics and Protestants, do you know, like, yep. Now it feels like militant, like I can't be friends with you, yep, if you're X. There's very little
extreme tribalism, and it's easy to sell that kind of like us against them, you know, fraternity mindset of like, this is, they don't, you know, and it's really easy to sell that bullshit. And it's why it's so easy to start like a cult, and it's so easy to, I mean, these wackadoodles who get people to follow them, because you just can, you just tell somebody that you're, that nobody understands you the way I do. And all of your, yeah. You know, and that's what Trump called, was telling racists and sexists and, you know, just, and then most of the rich corporate people just like, oh, he's going to win this for us, and we're just going to get rich. And they don't, you know, and that's exactly what's happening. And that's all that Trump's doing too. Trump doesn't care about abortion. He's just knows how to get rich off of other people's fear, you know? And that's what they all are doing. And so, and everyone's suffering, and it's, yeah, it's really a dark thing.
He's like a, you know, like he's been somebody who's been ubiquitous to New York. Like you can't look around the skyline without seeing something that's been trumped by either him or his dad over the last like 100 years or so. I wanted to touch on New York a little bit, because it's the probably what the most important place in the Nationals history, really. Like it is the National, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Nationals formed there and actually formed there 3 years after, 3 or 4 years after I moved there. And yeah, the National never played a gig in Cincinnati until years later when we toured back and did some shows in Cincinnati after, you know. And so the Nationals was never really a Cincinnati band. It was very much I had a band in Cincinnati called Nancy, and so did Aaron and Bryce and Brian were in a different band. But the National formed in Brooklyn in this old shitty loft that I had down by the Gowanus Canal. And we were very much a New York band, really probably maybe as influential. I mean, we had all these different influences that we were trying to square with each other, but then we would all go out and see, you know, Interpol and all these bands in New York, and we're in Walkman and Strokes and Yeah Yeah Yeahs and TV on the Radio and all that stuff. And just were so motivated to figure out how to be a band that good as those bands. And yeah, so I really think of, when I think of New York, I think of the National. You know, I've lived here in California now for 7.5 years, but yeah, even when, you know, I don't know how much I've been thinking. I mean, I always think about New York, and I always think about Ohio, and I've been writing about California even when I was in New York. But, excuse me, the National feels like that. And yeah, well, what I'm doing now feels more, you know, unmoored to a place. And maybe more influenced by all of them a little bit now, all these places, California, Ohio, Indiana, New York, you know, all that stuff is kind of what I write about now.
Do you ever like sit down and like, cause obviously I saw in an interview where like, you know, not jealous, but like, you were coming up the same time as the Strokes, but like nobody would spit on you guys for the first couple of years. Whereas like, you know, yeah. they were really getting their moment, but like ultimately if I look at it as a fan, I'd be like, you kind of outlasted them all and hit your creative peak a lot later than they did. Like, I think the Strokes kind of had a lot of glory. Like, I mean, they're still a very good band. I saw them, probably, I think it was the last gig I went to. I saw them in London this year. But they had a lot of fame very early, whereas you had to really earn yours and build up into it.
We were really, honestly, we were really lucky that nobody paid attention to us, because if we had been sort of like the spotlight that was on the Strokes, the Strokes brought the spotlight to New York, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, you could say Jonathan Fireeater, you know, was this thing in New York, which was the first thing that led to sort of this, there's always like a first, and then there's a second wave and a third wave. Jonathan Fireeater was the first wave, you know, kind of on their own. And then the Strokes and Interpol and all that stuff. The Strokes very specifically brought in the big, like just ushered in that second wave. And such a huge spot. I mean, every single one of the Strokes was on their, was their faces on Spin, you know, individually, yeah. you know. you know, Fab had his own spin cover with just his face on it, you know? And so that kind of global massive fetishes, you know, they were just fetishized by me, by everyone. And they deserved it. They're that good, but that's, and all those bands, it's really like Interpol and all of it. It's easy to, for people to like, just focus on that. And then it's hard to evolve past that. It's just not on, and it's not their fault. It's just hard for people's idea of them to evolve. Right. So, we were really lucky that nobody paid attention, because if people kind of judged us on our first two or three records, it would probably, you know, it would, we weren't that great yet. You know, we had potential, we were getting there, but I don't think we got good until Alligator, you know, and that's what most people kind of agree. We showed a lot of, so we were really lucky that we didn't come into like that third wave of those New York bands. And I guess we didn't have to shake off people's ideas of us, because nobody had the same idea, because mm-hmm. certain people had idea of what we started out as, and then there's this new thing. And so we kind of confused the expectations. And then we made Boxer, which even I think was really smart for us to avoid anything that people liked about our previous success, yeah. Alligator, sort of, you know, the screamy stuff. We, at that point, we would learn, like, do not let anybody put you in a corner, because just get out of all your corners, because it's more fun to not be in a corner creatively. And it's really dangerous if you try to cater to what you think your fans expect. It's much more fun and exciting to not care what your fans expect and not know what you expect yourself. So we were lucky that way, that nobody would spit on us for 5 years.
Then,
thank God.
you doing this solo album, then, like, creatively, does that mean that it opens up a different side for another national album? Like, can you, like, whatever creative itch this is scratched, does that mean that, like, wherever you go next will sound different to what you've done here? Obviously it's with different creators and stuff, but
yeah, probably. I mean, I never like going back, you know. Nobody in the national likes going back to, I mean, and so this record, I discovered all kinds of things that I think I will always remember when I go, or when I'm writing, or when I'm in the studio. But every time the National works with anybody, and anytime, you know, anybody comes into the National, or anybody works with it, like Aaron working with Taylor Swift, or us working with Justin or Sufjan Stevens, and even everybody that tours with us, and everybody that came on tour with I Am Easy to Find, we had so many people involved that Gaylen Dorsey, who's also on this record, just really kind of, I learned a lot about singing from her. I've learned a lot from every opening band we've ever had, you know, and just the same way I learned everything from every band I opened for. I mean, the National learned so much from the Walkmen. I think the National opening for Walkmen and right around Alligator was what changed the National, you know. We're like, holy, you know, if we're going to compete, we got to be as good as these guys. And so all of this stuff definitely changes all the wiring and all the chemistry for all of us as artists. So I know that I wouldn't expect, when the National gets back together, it's going to be, it'll be new territory. And I think the National's gone down some really deep roads in, I would say, somewhat similar territory between Sleep Well Beast and I Am Easy to Find, and even the Cyrano de Bergerac musical that Aaron and Bryce and my wife Corin and I have written all the songs and music for. Mm-hmm. Those very different types of things, but going very far out onto certain branches. I think the National, when we get back together, will you know, try to plant a new tree instead of keep going out onto some of these branches that I feel like we've kind of
techno. I think
disco,
really dark Berlin.
We've talked a lot about like an acoustic disco album. We've talked a lot about doing an album just like in one day. And
I like that idea.
Writing, recording, and releasing. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the National, we've kind of done so many fun, crazy things, even with shows and touring. And, you know, we played acoustic for an astronaut while she was in space, you know. It's almost like, well, what the hell are we going to do now? I think we've all kind of talked about when we get back together, let's just start from scratch, you know, kind of back to basics. And so that's probably, but for us, back to basics, nobody knows what that means anymore.
Yeah,
there are all these new discoveries that are our new basics. Well, like, so our basics will be very maybe different than our basics were 20 years ago. Yeah.
My final question, seeing as you were talking about like how much you've learned from being in the National, from the Walkmen, from opening for them, when you can go and tour this album yourself solo, who mm-hmm. do you want to open for? Who do you think you could learn from as a solo artist?
I would love to open for, I'd love to open for Idols. You know, I just, well, just because they're such a fun hang, and I just, and their shows are so cathartic, and I love that band, and so the idea of being able to like do a Serpentine Prison show and then just go get loaded and mosh somewhere to an Idols sounds like the best night ever for me. But yeah, I don't know, every time I open for anybody I learn so much. I would like to like do a small tour. I mean, like a you know, skeleton crew type of a you know thing with some other, you know, skeleton crew artist that's or something that's just, you know, really small. Everybody in the same bus, or at least not a big giant train of yeah. vehicles. You know,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, I that's all I can afford to do anyway. It's like, you know, maybe it's a van tour. I wouldn't mind doing like one more van tour around America. With you know, everybody who's on the record, but whoever can fit in the van, I guess.
That's it. Well, like, who knows? There could be a basketball court out there for you to play sometime in 2021.
Somewhere. Yeah, maybe a farmer's market or something. Somewhere.
Is that a nice, like, deli or something like that? Matt, yeah. thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me. And there was like 100 questions that I'd written that we didn't get onto, and I'm kind of happy because this was way more interesting than my shit questions. So thank you, man. Thank you for the music. Thank you for the demo. Thank you for your time, and good luck with the album, and good luck with the rest of 2020. We all need it.
Yeah, and beyond. Likewise, same to you, man. Take care.
Cheers, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.